Everybody, Mike here for Rock Under Fire. I'm here with my six-year-old nephew, Donut Hole. What's up, Donut Hole?
Hi.
So as I was listening to playback of the last episode, our recent one that we recorded with a guest, it occurred to me that we had such a great conversation that we didn't even give our guest a proper introduction. So on our show this week, episode 61 of Rock Under Fire, is Joe Jarolski, a friend that goes back to way back to middle school with us and back through the early 80s and our initial years as metal fans. And Joe grew up in Forres, New Jersey, along with the rest of us. And, you know, his dad had multiple record stores in the area. And so we talk about Little Joe Records and various places that they sold music at, a lot of great stuff back in the day, where you can get a lot of stuff that you just couldn't get in your local Sam Goody back in the 80s and early 90s. And as I'm finding out, the 70s, you know, it was a great conversation. We talked a little bit about the music of today and how we've kind of transcended different musical styles and listening habits and things like that through adulthood, you know, after not having talked or seen each other for many, many years. So it was a really great conversation. And again, I just had to tack this intro on because it occurred to me that, you know, we never gave Joe a proper introduction. I mean, we barely even mention our podcast name half the time. You know, we don't have any advertisers. We don't have to deal with any of that, all that preliminary stuff that gets tacked on at the first 15 minutes of most podcasts. So, you know, we've been doing these shows through phone calls for the past 6 months, and they sound like shit. I get it. That's part of the charm of our show. Anyway, enjoy a great discussion for the next 90 minutes. Joe Jarolski.
Found out that, you know, you were Little Joe's Records, man. He was like, yeah, man, let's get him on the show. Let's fucking do this.
Now, that's your dad, huh?
Yeah. He had, I think, about 7 stores total throughout my childhood.
Yeah. Yeah. I knew of, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I knew of the Cherry Street store in Railway, and I was in there a lot. I was in that store.
I worked there all the time. I don't know. It's weird.
That's strange. You know, we had to.
I probably knew you then.
Yeah.
But, yeah, just didn't put 2 and 2 together.
Sure. I was with a tall kid. Keith. I'm from Rawley. That's why I'm not from Woodbridge. But a friend of mine, Keith, I was always in there with him. You had to remember him. He was like 6-something with like real long black hair. But we're always in there looking for good video bootleg. He had the best selection of bootleg videos like anywhere.
Right.
And I can remember getting like Iron Maiden videotapes and stuff. Just amazing. It was just, when Mike told me that, I literally, like, jaw hit the floor because I remember the Ford store. Now, didn't he have one in Linden too, next to the old Pathmark?
No.
Yes.
Yeah. His first store was in Newark, actually in 1970.
Wow.
And then his second store was actually in Ford's again. I think I was 10, so 1980, and then he opened another store. I think it was the Rawley was next. I think I was like 16, so 86.
Yeah, that puts me at that age too.
Yeah, and then he did another one on New Brunswick Ave about 4 or 5 years later, and then another one. I forgot the name of the street, but right across the street from Dunkin' Donuts and Ford's.
Yeah.
That's the one I remember.
Behind the auto, there's like an auto parts store there.
Yep. And that's the one that he had all the celebrities go to. We had a ton of people.
I remember Rob Halford being there.
Yep.
In 93, I think, around there, 91, 92, like right when Fight began.
Yep. Yeah, it was a Premier 4 fight, that's why.
Right, right. And I'll never forget this, man. I don't know. I might have been drunk or something. We were day drinking, I think. And the big news was Rob Halford's going to be in Forge. Rob Halford's going to be in Forge. We got to go see Rob Halford, man, you know? And I could not get up off my ass. My friend Eric, not Ian Nelly, but another Eric, man, actually the guy who sings our theme music, the voice behind our theme song, he got up and he's like, yeah, I'm gonna go meet Rob Halford. And I never went, man. And I kicked myself in the ass after that, man. He came back with a picture, man, and he got, you know, and I was like, Jesus Christ, man. Damn, man. So I regretted that for a long time.
Yeah. A lot of people did.
When did your dad finally hang it up?
Probably late 90s, mid-90s. And then he went back to doing, like, he's an electronic technician.
Okay.
And then when my mom died in 2005, he retired. But then he started doing, like, CDs and tapes in, like, flea markets. But he moved down to South Carolina and started doing that down there.
Oh, cool. Is he currently down there now?
No, he passed away 5 years ago.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
But he was doing it then, and me and my brother had to pick up all the stuff.
Yeah, so you mentioned that he had stores as early back as 1980. Do you remember 70. That far back, or 70s? Like, yeah, do you remember that far back? And what are your memories of those stores back then, man, in terms of back in the days, right in the epicenter of vinyls, popularity, man. Like, you know, do you have any like vivid memories of those days?
Yeah, actually, I loved it. I used to go to work after school. Some weekends they'd bring me there, and actually he was partners with his best friend at the time, and it was called J&N. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm J&B, I think.
Right. Record.
And the big thing was, like you said, the vinyl and A-tracks were still around. And try to think of the Pink Floyd was huge at the time. I remember him selling a ton of The Wall.
Yeah.
I might have gotten a cassette version in. I'm sorry, I keep cutting you off. This is so difficult when you're not in the same room. God, please, I'm sorry, Joe.
Okay.
I remember just the massive end caps and big cardboard displays of The Wall, like everywhere you went. You know, if you remember before. Now, I mean, you grew up in Fords and I grew up in Fords. So, I mean, aside from your experience through, you know, records, obviously, because your dad had so many stores and you grew up around it, was much different than mine. For me, it was, you know, when you were a teenager in the early 80s, early to mid 80s, you know, it was like vintage vinyl was literally in right in back of my house, like two blocks behind my house. Or else before vintage vinyl, if you remember, you went to Two Guys or you went to Corvette, you know, or you got, you know, or there was a record section in ShopRite.
Yeah. Sam Goody's in the mall.
Yep.
And that too, yeah. That, for whatever reason, I didn't go much. I wasn't a Woodbridge Mall kid. If I went to the mall, we usually went to Menlo, it was the Music Den, I think.
Record World. Record World was there, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
There was
Record Town in Woodbridge, I think.
I had, when I first moved to Jersey, I was in Elizabeth, and I had Alwick Records.
Oh, we didn't have them.
I remember Alwick, man, and there was also Vogels. Do you remember Vogels?
I remember Vogels too.
It was on the same street. North Broad.
What was that?
I remember that.
You had to get your tickets from there too for any concerts that you were trying to go to and stuff. But Alwick was good. And then when I moved to Rahway, we had Soundarama, and Cherry Street was your dad. And I mean that I spent hours in your dad's place just because of the sheer. I hate, you know, you don't want to say bootleg stuff, but yeah, there was good bootleg stuff. There was that was going on then. You know, there was trading and buying and selling of bootleg material that was just great. I mean, if you didn't get to see a concert, you know, A, because I was young, B, because I couldn't afford it, I could possibly pick it up on cassette or even VHS, which was even better. Old Kiss shows and stuff like that, which was just, it was phenomenal, man. It was just absolutely phenomenal.
It's funny so you said, go ahead.
I just wanted to find out, did you start working for your dad as early in, like what year did you start? Was he already in Fords, or, I mean, it was after the Newark stuff?
Well, in 1980, he would just basically, you know, bring me along on days that I was home from school, and I would just basically hang out and, you know, load some records up or some tapes and, you know, just basically hang out. For the Cherry Street, I worked there a lot. I started driving. So basically, pretty much I would actually call out sick from school and go to work.
Nice.
Yeah, and then I got in trouble a couple of times when I was on the football team because I did that. But my dad couldn't afford anybody, so I was free help.
Yeah, sure. And you got to sit around and listen to music all day, man. It had to be
You pretty much had access to everything you wanted, right, in terms of whatever was in the inventory and what was coming out and everything that was new, man. You probably heard before everybody else.
Pretty much, because the good thing about it was all the record companies would send us promos and samples. That was all mine, so...
Did you keep anything into adulthood, any like prized possessions of like things that were rare or things that you're like, shit, I'm holding on to this, that the general public didn't have access to?
Mostly the pre stuff. I kept that stuff. For a while, I kept everything. I hoarded it. And then when I go to college and I really couldn't afford it, I sold off a lot of it to pay for college.
Right.
But I kept all the pre stuff. But the one thing I do have is when I was interning for Epic Records, my boss had a limited edition Ozzy promo. I think it was like 5 tracks. It actually had an unreleased instrumental from Zakk Wylde on it. And it was also signed to Ozzy. Mm-hmm. So I've seen that go for anywhere between 2 to 3,000.
Wow.
That was pretty cool. I still have that. I kept that one.
What was that around the time of, like, No Rest for the Wicked or something like that? Or maybe a little
years.
Exact. That's more cool.
Yeah, I was interning there from, I think, 90 to 91.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Okay. Was it Zach's audition stuff, or was it just stuff that never made the record?
Just never made the record.
Oh, okay.
They put it out just for this. And actually, the funny thing, too, is inside the CD is a piece of art from Ozzy that was never, you know, put out anywhere because he was doing drawings or paintings or something like that. So that's there also.
That's cool, man.
Yeah, that's cool.
You know, I total off topic, man. You mentioned Allwilk before, man. I was just thinking about Allwilk the other day because Vandenberg came up in conversation, and I have this memory of the only time I ever went into Allwilk Records. It was a Saturday. I'll never forget this. And the reason I remember this, because I remember everything about this day, I went to Allwilk Records. I was in Elizabeth visiting my cousin. And I bought Vandenberg's first record.
This burning
which
heart.
They had three albums out by then. This was in 86. And I remember it because I bought the first Vandenberg record. We went to see the movie Trick or Treat. It's like this like heavy metal movie with Gene Simmons and Ozzy doing cameos. And then, like, coming home, and it was game 6 of the World Series, or the Mets and, you know, the Mets and Red Sox World Series. That crazy, crazy game.
Game 6.
Yeah, so that was that day. But when you said Allwilk, man, I always remember, you know, I associate those three events with that record store. But anyway.
Allwilk Records for me was my very first experience with record shop employees that were snobs. Not all of them were, but that particular place, they were very snobbish. And there were a few other record stores that I'd gone into throughout the years that they're just snobs. And it irked me, and I kind of hated going in there, but you still wanted to go in there because it's a record store, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, those people do exist, man. What was the movie? That movie was it High Fidelity?
Yeah.
Or was Jack Black or one of those?
Yeah, that was it.
Is it the same movie where they just kind of like, yeah. Yeah, that shit's real. You know.
But there's an actual another full feature documentary out, Tower Records. Tom Hanks' kid directed it. I actually recently watched it, and it went through the whole history of Tower Records and how they became what they became and the demise of them and everything. And they admittedly, they were like, you know, we were snobs. We treated customers like shit, but they kept coming back because we were playing the hippest, newest stuff, and we were selling everything. It was almost they had to come back because we were selling everything that they wanted.
This was Tower?
Yeah.
Wow, yep. Man.
Yeah,
Tower,
a great documentary.
Tower became Sam Goody, right? I mean, Tower was this big by the time that they closed, they were huge. They were like this big
international. Yeah, go ahead, Joe. You can finish that. I know we're just gonna say the same thing. Please go ahead.
Yeah. They were over in Japan, they got so big.
Yeah.
And then
huge.
Yeah.
Huge. They ultimately just wore themselves a little thin. They were spending more than they were making, and then the banks just came in and took them over and just closed up shop. But yeah, they might have had 10. They might have had 10 stores in Japan or something.
Something like that.
Hugely, insanely popular.
Wow.
That record store vibe is dead.
Yeah,
it was anyway. I'm surprised vintage vinyl has lasted so long.
Mm-hmm.
They do a lot of online business from what I hear.
You have to.
You get a lot of people coming in from New York City and stuff.
Still a cool place to go thumb through some records, though, and listen to something good. That place always reminds me of High Fidelity, actually.
your store, Joe, I have my favorite memory of your store is, and it's like I always wanted to tell you this story. I may have told you this. I don't know. But in 1981, man, Peter Frampton put out an album called Breaking All the Rules. I don't know if you know Frampton or his catalog or whatever, but this song came out and it was on the radio, and the title track was on the radio, and I loved it. I was like 11 in 81. I guess we all were.
Right.
And I remember hearing it on, I guess I was still listening to PLJ at the time because PLJ was still a rock station. And either I had PLJ or WNEW. At the time, and Breaking All the Rules was like all over the radio, FM at, you know, I guess that summer.
Right.
And after about 2 months, it disappeared. And, you know, because I was 11 and I didn't have money, I was always dependent on whatever my dad was listening to. And so he would buy records and, you know, occasionally I would buy something. You know, I was usually buying like Kiss records, or by that point in time, it was like Cheap Trick in the Cars by 80, 81, 80, you know.
Right.
It was Cheap Trick in the Cars. But, you know, you basically had to wait for your parents to buy you a record. You
Absolutely.
Know? And so, you know, it was just a record that I never knew anything about. I wasn't a Peter Frampton fan. I loved the song. And then it disappeared. And then I forgot about it for years. And then I got into metal anyway around middle school. So for years, I always wondered about this rare, forgotten Peter Frampton song that I used to hear on the radio, you know, and then I found it on one of my dad's cassettes, you know, an old TDK, because he used to record everything from the radio. And then one day I'm in your store, and this was in like 92, 93. I was at Dunkin' Donuts, and then I, you know, just randomly wandered across the street to the store, and I'm looking, and I'm like, Peter Frampton, Breaking All the Rules. What is this? I've never seen this before. I was like, I wonder if this is it. You know, it was on a cassette. It was like $4, man, you know? And I grabbed that thing, and I raced home, and sure enough, man, that was the fucking song that I heard, I guess, 12, 13 years. Like, you know, you're 13 years, 12 years is a long time when you're a kid.
Absolutely.
You know, so it's like an eternity, man, that this fucking forgotten song, and there it was, man. So, I credit your store, man, with reconnecting me with one of my very favorite songs to this day, man. I've actually posted it a couple times, like in our little, you know, song challenges and stuff.
Right.
But it's a little long-winded story, but, you know, when you have these fucking you know, these mystery songs that you hear as a kid or songs that you totally loved or you forgot about. And you're like, oh my God, I remember this, man. But, yeah, it was like one of those, like holy shit moments.
So what started you driving, or what was the driving force to get you into metal?
For me?
Yeah, Joe.
Mike,
I hear Mike talking about metal all the time. Let's hear Joe's outfit, because Joe's working in a record store. And at that age, to me, I would have wanted
to be
your best friend.
He just has better stories than us, man.
I would have wanted to be your best friend.
believe it or not, my first memories of music, I think the two first bands I was into, and you're going to laugh at one, was Sean Cassidy.
Me too. Wow.
And Kiss.
Me too.
Yeah. Those are my first two.
But we're in that same age. We're all the same age. So, I mean, Sean Cassidy was popular music then. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You have to know right off the bat, man, when I bought Love Gun, there was a second album that I bought, and it was Sean Cassidy's first record.
Yep.
You know, I bought them together in the summer of 77.
Yep.
Had two guys. All right, so go ahead.
Two guys, which is over in Ford's. What is it now?
It was in Hope One. It was a Walmart there now.
Yeah, yeah. And then basically it kind of broke off. You know, actually, I was into the Bee Gees at the time. Mm-hmm. But I guess Kiss is the first metal. And then basically that transitions into Zeppelin, AC/DC. But I was very big into, you know, other stuff too, like the Kinks.
Okay.
Never liked the Beatles.
Wow.
Never
really?
Liked. Oh, I hated the Beatles.
Stones.
Loved the Stones.
Oh, wow.
Loved the Kinks. Kinks were probably my favorite regular rock band at the time.
Oh. Okay.
And then, you know, I'd say probably Priest hit for me in like 1981.
And then earlier than me. Wow.
And then it just took off from there. It was nothing but metal.
Right. Now obviously you're still listening to it these days, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's still, actually, believe it or not, I kind of hate people who like metal. It's weird. Because they've become like metal snobs now. You know, so like, you say you're a metalhead and you like Kiss, and they're like, oh, Kiss isn't metal. Or you like, I don't know, let's say Motley Crue. Oh, they're not metal. Metal's All That Remains or Killswitch. That's metal. The other stuff isn't metal. It's rock.
Cookie Monster vocals.
Right, right. So you got a lot of those metal snobs now. So it's like, I don't even, you know.
Well, they're also half our age, and they weren't there, so they don't really know the what. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, it seems like,
understand the foundation,
like millennials.
Yeah, the foundation, the birth of it. I mean, the birth of it was obviously just before our time, but we lived through a good part of it.
Oh yeah, it's like
Priest in their prime.
True. You know what it seems like though? Like to kids that are listening to metal today, you know, their idea of metal is they look at bands like Judas Priest and Iron Maiden. In AC/DC, like they look at that stuff the way we looked at like Frank Sinatra and like Elvis Presley, you know, like seriously, because it was 30 years before, like in the 80s, the 50s was 30 years before. So now it's kind of like the 80s were 30 years before what the kids are listening to today. So it's kind of prime. It's like this primitive form of metal. They know it rocks. They know it's heavy. You know, they know it was called metal at one time, but they can't relate to it.
Yeah. I mean, so, I would say one thing. Most of them do appreciate Priest and Maiden. I got to give them that. They do seem to appreciate them, but everything else is basically either that's rock or hard rock. But then I guess right now you could say I'm probably just, you know, more of a hard rocker than anything.
Yeah, you know, at some point it just becomes rock.
Yeah.
You
know? Well, it's all under the same category. So guitar rock for me. That's what I like to generalize it as. I'm going to listen to it. So,
I think for the most part, some of those young kids respect bands like Anthrax too, because I remember seeing them at Starland.
Well, no, they consider Anthrax metal. It's like Anthrax and like Metallica, Overkill. They, to them, that's the start of metal.
Yeah, that's the threat. The thrash stuff was the start of it for them, right? And I, you know, on the flip side, I've seen bands like Killswitch, which are really great. I like that. I don't mind it. I'm not really going out and buying their stuff, but I'll go to a show to see that and see the you know, to get that young feeling again. That's what it kind of does for me. It makes me feel young being at a show like that.
Yeah, I try to go as much as I can, especially Starland. You can see a lot of good bands there. Cheap.
Yeah, true. They're doing good. Every time BLS rolls through there, I'm always there. It's just a great place to see them. It's like a homecoming for them.
Yep. But I have to admit, when I was in high school, I was kind of a metal snob. If it wasn't metal, I didn't want to listen to it.
There was a lot of people that did, like our generation, man, that went through that.
And it's a shame, too. Well, there's a lot of other good music.
Oh, yeah, there was, right. And I was going to just say, I don't know if we were snobs. I think we were looked at. I just think that we were looked at so differently that we were more alienated than anything. And it was just like, okay, so now I do have this chip on my shoulder, so fuck you. And now, you know, my metal's going to get louder, my metal's going to get faster, my metal's going to just really drive you fucking insane. At least in my case. I don't think it was more – I don't think I was so snobbish then. I'm snobbish now.
I think it was – I definitely went through a very long snob period, man, to an extent. I still kind of am, although I try not to show it. But I think it was a little different with a lot of people with metal. Like, I was just talking to – I did a few weeks ago, I did an episode with Mike Nierenberg. He was on our show, like, real early in when we started the Rock Under Fire show, and he was like at episode 10, and then he came back a few weeks ago, and we were talking about this, man. I think that with metalheads, especially if you grew up in the 80s like we did, there was a lot of alienation, man, and there were a lot of legitimate angry kids, man, that had fucked up lives, man. You know, like, just fucked up home lives, man. Very little, you know, interaction with any sort of, like, parental figure or authority figure, man. Are we getting in trouble, man? Fuck the world, you know? That was, like, legitimately their attitude, man. But I think a lot of kids, man, got into metal. It was peer pressure and the type of thing where there was almost, like, a stress to it, man, where you had to look a certain way, you had to dress a certain way, you had to act a certain way. It was, like, all based on image. You felt like, you know, you liked this band because you felt like you were supposed to.
Yeah.
Everybody else was listening to it. And that's why I know I got into metal. Like, you know, I got into metal late. It was like 7th, 8th grade already. And I was like, shit, man, maybe I better start listening to this stuff, man. You know, because The Who just doesn't seem cool to everybody, man. You know, and I walked into middle school a Who freak. I mean, The Who was the best band on the planet as far as I didn't give a fuck about Judas Priest, man. But I walked out of middle school the biggest Priest fan on the planet, next to you, Joe. You know, you and Tom Gizek were probably the biggest Kiss fans in existence. I mean, Kiss fans. What the fuck am I saying? Judas Priest, man. But anyway, so yeah, it just seemed like a lot of people, there's like this image. People were so hung up and almost like beholden to this image of what metal was versus what metal wasn't. You remember words like poser?
No,
words
no,
like, you know, false metal. You had bands like Manowar saying, this is false metal. Each note I now play be a black arrow of death sent straight to the hearts of all those who play false metal. You know, and it was like, it got to that, man. So, it, you know, by the time 86 rolls around and you got, you know, Slayer and Anthrax and, you know, Master of Puppets came out and Rain and Blood came out, and it just kind of redefined the rules, man.
It did.
Suddenly you had bands like Priest being called posers, and Maiden, they were posers, and even Ozzy, the fucking Prince of Darkness, was being referred to as a poser by some Slayer fans, you know?
It was almost like
bullying. What was that, Jeff?
Bullying people into to liking metal.
Yeah, so it was like kind of like, you know, and I just came to this conclusion, man, that the biggest posers of them all were the metalheads, man, the punks and the metalheads, because it was all based on appearance. It was based on people like trying to define what is and what isn't metal, what is and what isn't punk. And they still do it, man.
Yeah, they still do it. You saw kids fucking three, like kids more than, like less than half our age, telling us what punk is, man. Like, yeah, man, you got a pin in your nose. Wow, man, you're a badass, man. You know, it's like, but anyway, yeah, it's just kind of like, if you're trying to define something, man, and tell it, say what it is and what it isn't, man,
you can't.
You're probably not the real deal.
Right.
The movie that defines that era, I think, would be River's Edge with Keanu Reeves. That it just describes everything you just said, Mike.
I have to see that movie. I know. I remember parts of that movie, man. That movie fucking...
Dennis
that was a little real dark.
Yeah, real dark.
It was a disturbing movie.
Yes,
it was.
Very dark.
It described that feeling of, like, you know, of us reaching out for that metal and being alienated and having a shitty home life. And, I think I could speak for all three of us. We weren't involved to the extent where there was a girl that was murdered or anything like that. But, mm-hmm. Drug abuse and stuff like that, it went down that road.
Yeah.
We just went dark. I think it's the first time we went that dark.
Yeah. What do you mean? Oh,
our metal era.
There definitely was some dark times with metal, but not to that extent for me.
Oh yeah, definitely not.
I don't remember. I mean, I remember the movie and I remember parts of it just being pretty disturbing. I never saw the movie beginning to end, so I don't know particularly what you're referring to, but I do remember it being like there was a dead body and it was like a group of bigger kids and a group of younger kids, I think, right?
Yeah, the guy killed his girlfriend and some other kids found it and they were like, you want to go down and see the body? And like nobody called the police about it. And it was just, but it was just, I only made that, I'm not using that part of it. The part of it where they were all just,
they bonded because teenagers.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Good save, Joe.
Which basically was my childhood, bonding because of music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was number one. Music was number one.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I associate the whole trip with a lot of fear, man. Because I wasn't one of the, like, you know, I hung out with Burnout. I wasn't a Burnout, but I hung out with them. So I guess I was associated as one.
Yeah, me too.
You know, I didn't, you know, do any drugs. I didn't do, although a lot of people thought I did, you know.
Guilty by association.
Kind of. And so there was always, you know, I was this overprotected kid, you know. My mother always knew where I was, wanted to know who I was with, where I was going. I wasn't allowed to hang out with this person and this person and this person. You know, you smell like smoke. Who are you? What were you doing? Who are you with? You know, that type of thing. So I didn't do too many risky things as a kid, man. And so I always associated, like, I remember going to the Battle of the Bands at OLP, you know, which we did, you know, two Fridays every 3 months, you know.
Yep.
And I just always, like, I think of those albums from 88, any metal between 82 and 86, you know, those Battle of the Band years, man, where you go on a Friday night, man, and everybody, there'd be the smoking room, you know, and there's, everybody had long hair and everybody looked badass. And I was this geeky kid, man, trying to look cool. And I'd be shit scared that any fucking, like, something horrible could happen at any given second. You know, like, there was going to be a fight, or somebody was going to get shot, or there was going to be a gang fight. It was, you know, there was always, like, the music always was accompanied by this sense of danger that never went away, man. And even when you got into bands, that sense of danger was always there. And I don't know, man, I don't know if anybody can relate to that, but, you know, even when you went to concerts, man, I remember going to L'Amour and being shit fucking scared, man. You know, I remember going to see Yngwie Malmsteen in, like, you know, like senior year, and being shit scared. Like, holy fuck, man.
I was the flip side of that, Mike. I was that Burnout you were talking about.
yeah, you were the Burnout, man.
Yeah, I definitely was.
Believe it or not, though, luckily with metal, it's not as dangerous as everybody makes it out to be. I never saw anybody get shot. I rarely ever saw a gang fight.
You're right.
It was just more of a persona.
Yeah. And once you got all those people in that building, there was a camaraderie there.
Yeah.
It was a brotherhood.
I guess I've been to some just really bad shows. I just remember going to I was at the Garden when they tore it up. You know, the Priest got banned from the Garden. I was there. They ripped the fucking shit out of that place. They destroyed the Garden, man. And then at Iron Maiden, they were setting cars on fire, man. Like a car fucking exploded in the parking lot. Another Priest concert, they literally destroyed the footbridge over Route 3. Like, I remember, like, stomping after, like, the kids were fucking punching the walls out with fucking cars driving by underneath us. It was, like, there were some freaky fucking times at those shows, man. You know? So I just remember, I associate that whole period with a lot of violence, a lot of fucking crazy, total, anarchic debauchery, man. Like, you know? And metal had a bad rap, you know, like we were Satanists, man. We were, you know, Ozzy was the devil. Everything bad that happened in the world was blamed on Ozzy or Judas Priest. You know, Kiss, whatever Kiss was accused of doing, I don't know. But
Night to the Pain Service.
I just remember, that was great.
Yeah,
the
Night
to
the
Pain
Service. But I remember like the Screaming for Vengeance tour, man. Like the first time we saw Priest. And going to the Vengeance tour, and it was a Vengeance, or was it Screaming for Vengeance? Defenders, one of those shows. And just knowing the reputation of metal and being like told, like just like believing the stereotype of metal, right? Before I actually experienced it firsthand, because I was a new metalhead, you know, I was seventh grade, and you know, my dad warning me, like, you wait until you see that concert, you'll see what goes on at those shows, you'll see I'm right, you know, and. And when I got there, man, everything about it, everything I was told was right in front of my eyes, man. It was like, I never smelled pot before until the Judas Priest concert, man. It was fucking contact high, you know? I mean, the whole Meadowlands Arena was just filled with fucking pot smoke. People standing on their chairs, man. Just total living proof that we descended from apes, man. You know? And then getting out of the venue, man, and just the beer bottles under our tires, man, fucking all kind of crazy shit, man. People throwing bottles. I mean, it really was fucked up, man. But it was a good time.
I'm not gonna deny. I won't deny that.
Just as a scared teenager, man, like that was just my own experience of it, man. You know.
Joe, who were some of your favorite guests that your dad got over in Ford's over there?
Well, of course, Halford.
Yeah.
He had the whole fight band there. So, you know, Scott Travis and Priest was in it. So that was good. And actually, Russ Parrish, who's actually now in Steel Panther. he was in the fight band at the time. So he was there.
I didn't know that. I never knew
that. Yeah, Satchel. Russ Parrish is Satchel. In Steel Panther. We had Overkill there.
Excellent.
Biohazard. Group called Circus of Power.
I remember Circus of Power.
Trying to think who else. Some of the local big bands like Nonfiction, Hades. Trying to think. I mean, Halford was the biggest. Then we had Life of Agony actually before they got signed.
Oh, wow.
Do you remember Bobby Steele from the Misfits?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had a band called, I think, Undead or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
He actually played.
The guy, Mike Nierenberg, who did our show a few weeks ago, he directed a few of his videos.
Yeah, they were actually pretty good. Life of Agony actually played, too.
Overkill had to be a good time. Those guys were a bunch of fun dudes, man.
Yeah, they were beyond cool.
When we were in school, Joe, wasn't there a teacher whose nephew was in Overkill? Do you know anything about? Do you remember anything about that?
Wasn't it the she was a The one who was a sergeant in the Marines or whatever.
Not sure.
I forgot. Yeah, but yeah, there was one like.
Local enough. I mean, they're right from Staten Island, so it's not like they're not local.
Overkill?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they literally. Who?
Say it again.
Schmeel, Mr. Schmeel.
I thought it was a
lady. Anyway, yeah, that's what I just think of when I hear Overkill. Okay.
These guys are still going at it, too, man. Record after record after record.
I'll tell you what. Their albums are still solid.
Yeah, man.
Still solid. They're probably one of the thrash bands that have kept it going well.
Yeah.
That's another thing I wanted to talk to you about. Do you have, Pat, actually, Pat, continue your thought, man. I keep interrupting you now.
Well, no, all I was going to say was my other band would be Anthrax, who I like a little bit more, but they've had their more ups and downs. And only, you know, recently I'd say their last two records were, you know, really good comebacks for that band, with Joey coming back and,
oh, but Joey's return album was fantastic.
Yeah, that to see them come back was just a really big thrill, man. And they were spot on, didn't miss a beat.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead, Mike. What was your point?
I forgot.
You let me throw mine out, and then you forget yours. Come on.
I forgot mine. No. It's like, oh yeah. So I mean, originally. Joe, we wanted to have you on the show a few years back. This goes back a few years because when Priest was up for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, we talked about, you know, what could we possibly do a show on? You know, do you want to come on? Do you want to talk about metal? Do you want to talk about Priest, whatever? And Priest was, you know, they were almost certain to get the nod. And then 2 years in a row, they didn't get it. And then whatever happened, you know, that fell apart. And then we were talking about it again back in February at Rob's party. And then the shutdown happened really quick.
Yeah.
That never happened. But anyway, it's crazy how, you know, Priest obviously is still around, man. But the difference between Priest and Maiden in 2020 or 2018, like the last tours that both of them did, 2019, whatever it was. If you remember back in the lunchroom, you and me used to sit at the same lunch table for a few years, and you remember the big war back then was always the Priest versus Maiden.
Yep.
Priest versus Maiden. I remember the digital message board in the cafeteria, and they actually had a contest, Judas Priest or Iron Maiden. And I think Maiden won.
But, yeah.
You know, we sat our lunch table, I think, was equal Priest Maiden fans. But, I mean, both bands were huge in the 80s. Pre-Metallica, Slayer, Maiden and Priest were the biggest metal bands until then. Exactly. And obviously, you know, we know the history that, you know, Maiden opened for Priest, and then after, you know, the Number of the Beast / Screaming for Vengeance tour, and then, you know, a year later, they were headlining for Peace of Mind. But they, you know, they had pretty much equal popularity by 84, 85. 30 years later now, I mean, how do you compare both bands? Obviously, if you look at attendance, concert attendance, Maiden by far is still one of the most popular bands worldwide.
Yes.
Priest kind of has had to scale down a bit in their venues. How do you think that they transcended the decades, both bands?
I'm a big fan of both. Don't get me wrong. I'm a huge fan of both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Priest is my favorite, but I'm a huge Maiden fan. The last three Maiden albums, I have a hard time listening to. They're that bad.
The last three, you said?
Yeah, I have a hard time listening to them. It's like,
wow, I like Book of Souls a lot.
Oh, I couldn't stand that album.
Wow.
Couldn't stand it. And I would say for Priest, the only album I really had no use for was, I forgot the name of it already. It's just so bad, I don't even pay attention to it.
Was it one of the Ripper albums?
No, that's a Ripper album that I didn't mind at all. It was the first one with the new guitarist.
Redeemer of Souls?
Yeah, I hated that album. Mm. Other than that, they've been solid. Like, the last album was fantastic. Firepower? I liked it.
Yeah,
a lot.
There were things I liked off of it. It was the one album since, I mean, I'm going to be honest, I got off the bus at Painkiller. You know, like, once I heard Painkiller, I was like, I'm done. Like, I'm in a total minority, man.
You got to listen to Angel of Retribution.
I didn't like it. I gave it to my cousin. I listened to it.
Yeah. That's one of my favorites.
I wasn't a fan of it, man. I appreciated it, man. I thought it was a much more... If there's any such thing, I think it was a more adult sounding metal album. You know, it had the passage of time and the passage of experience that Halford couldn't have really written when he was in his 20s and 30s. But maybe it was just me, man. I mean, my problem with Priest was that they got too heavy. You know, I liked Priest, 70s and 80s Priest, man, and once they did Painkiller.
Painkiller was a solid album, though. It really was.
It was much better than Ram It Down, man.
Yeah.
You know, I hated Ram. I mean, there's three songs I like on Ram It Down, but it was a good album, but I think the problem was that I changed. You know, I changed a lot. My musical taste changed, and
you got out of metal, so that'll...
Yeah, and it seems like they just stayed heavy. They got heavier and heavier. And the reason I like Firepower so much is because they went back to that melodic, hummable Priest, where you can hum the song and it stays in your head and it's catchy.
Well, actually, they had the Nostradamus album,
yeah.
which was very mellow. It wasn't a great album, but it wasn't heavy at all.
I heard parts of that. I mean, every time Priest did put it out an album, I did give it a chance. Yeah. Out of curiosity, I listened. You know, some of them I only listened to once. Some of them I didn't listen to the whole thing. Some of them I listened to like 30 seconds of a song, you know, because it was like, you know, I'm looking for a very particular sound. And, I mean, I don't know if you play any instruments, but, like, if you play guitar, like, it's very noticeable that once, you know, what happened with metal in the 90s when all of the guitarists started tuning, they started down-tuning. So their E string goes down, they drop it down to D, and some
right.
of them even lower. And that whole, you know, corn sounds, and that whole, like, you know, it just didn't, I don't know, it was not what I was looking for. And
it's a different type of metal, yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
But yeah, for me, I don't think Maiden has hung in there. I don't know, I just... I think a lot of it has to do with Bruce's vocals. I think he sounds like he's, I don't want to say straining, but he...
He could be. He's an old man.
Yeah. And you know what? I like the fact that Halford has changed. He pretty much got rid of the falsetto and only uses it sparingly now.
Mm.
But his voice... is still as powerful as ever without the falsetto.
I seem like he was struggling for a long time, though. You know,
yeah.
It seemed like,
yeah.
You know,
I
remember watching that. Remember the VH1 Rock Honors?
Yeah, but not even that. I mean, that one, then there was the what's it called, Download Fest, which used to be Castle Donington. And I just think he sounded, both them and Kiss, I just think they were just not on. I was just like, oh, this is horrible. They were like a bad reflection of themselves.
I think that with Maiden, the problem with Bruce is that, and I think I disagree in a sense that I think Bruce is in far better physical shape than Halford. And I think he's been in much better shape vocally, but I think where Dickinson is showing strain is because Maiden is still pretty much playing in the same keys that they were playing in the 80s, whereas Priest dropped their keys down so Halford can sing those songs. You know, because Halford for many years was struggling, and the only way they could bring back songs like Rock Hard, Ride Free, and Devil's Child, like, would be to drop the key.
Right.
Yeah, and they all do that. They're all guilty.
Yeah. And Maiden, I mean, they seem like, I don't know. I mean, if they are, maybe they're lowering it a half step, if that. But he's still, like, doing, like, a lot of the theatrics he was doing 30 years ago, man. And he's going to hurt himself.
Shit is.
He's going to hurt himself, man.
I saw the Book of Souls tour. I was just blown away by the stage show. I was like, wow, man, these guys are just still killing it.
What boggles my mind, man? Not boggles my mind. I guess I understand it because there were always far bigger, like, places like India and just anywhere in South America, man, in Europe, than they were here, and they were always huge here. So, but Maiden is just like their popularity all over the world is like they're just as big today, if not bigger, than they were in the 80s. And that's the crazy thing, you know. Yeah, they don't have albums on the charts, but they never really did, you know. And they don't even have that MTV airplay anymore, you know. The college stations are playing them the way SOU used to play them back in the 80s. So they're doing it with virtually zero commercial exposure. And that's what blows me away, is how they're able to still pull that off, man. But not so much as one radio hit. Like nothing. Like
not
they've done it all from the ground up, man. And I mean, you know, you could say like Metallica equally. They're equal popularity too over the years. But Metallica had albums on the charts. Metallica is records charted, man. They've won awards.
Metallica is the, I think, the highest selling group of all time now. Over the
Are
Beatles.
They? Wow.
For download.
Oh, downloads. Okay.
Yeah, they the Beatles were ahead of them, and they got ahead of the Beatles.
Wait a second. Wait. Metallica leads downloadable music right now?
Yep, all time.
That is huge in that they were the forefathers of fighting digital media. I can't even believe that. I believe your statement, Joe, obviously. I just can't believe that has happened. I'm blown away by that. They were so fucking hell-bent on digital media. Obviously, it was Napster and sharing music and this and that, that it just left such a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths, and now they're leading the way. I'm fucking amazed by that.
Because they're getting paid.
Yeah, there you go. Good point.
Money talks.
So,
that's crazy.
Yeah, how do you feel about the digital wave coming from you know, a record shop owner, and now that you know the digital wave is upon us? Do you regularly use like iTunes or Spotify or something like that?
Believe it or not, I still buy CDs and I throw it on my computer and then put it on my phone. So
okay,
there's very 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 few things I'll download. I pretty much buy it all.
That's the same school Eddie Trunk. He'll rip the CD on. You know, he still buys the physical media and he rips it and puts it onto his iTunes account or his phone or whatever he does.
That's what I do.
Yeah, I was doing that for a little while myself, and then have recently kind of just gone all digital.
It's very convenient. It makes me lazy. It's kind of nice to have. I'll admit it, man. It's nice to have Spotify, although you know a lot of people hate it. But I still buy whenever I can. You know, I'm always buying vinyl.
I like owning the music.
Yeah. You like, it's like nice. It's nice having something in your hand to look at, and you get like the, especially vinyl, man. I forgot how much I missed vinyl until I started getting it again.
But to Joe's point, to Joe's point right there, you physically own it. Like I don't own anything. I mean, I can physically buy. I could buy stuff from iTunes, but I have Apple Music, where I don't even own any of it. It's just I can listen to whatever I want, whenever I want. You can say, "Hey,
that's
have you
crazy.
Heard this?" And I can have it instantly. I don't own any of it. I mean, I have music, but you know, I have music that'll keep you going for you know a good few days.
Hey Pat, think about this, man. Like you just made it a good point. Like really, like think about how crazy this is. Like we. If we're streaming music, right, we're paying for Spotify, whatever it is, or Amazon, or not Amazon, the Apple Music, whatever it is. have, you know, like I, Spotify, I've accumulated a shitload, man, like thousands of albums and songs on Spotify, right? What happens if like Spotify goes under or something happens, man, where, you know, there's no Spotify, man, like we lose all that shit.
You got no music.
That's it. Exactly. So, and I tell myself this all the time. I'm like, you know, I'm just renting this. You know, I'm just like holding this for somebody. It's kind of like being like occupying, like watching somebody's house when they go on vacation. And then now you have access to their music collection for the summer. You know,
Willy,
it's like kind of like that.
Willy Wonka.
Exactly.
Told you, good day, sir. Good day, sir.
Hey, when the zombie apocalypse hits, I'll have my music.
Exactly. And that's why I still have my CD collection. I still have my vinyl collection, and I had to reaccumulate a lot of my vinyl. But yeah, man, I've got my music collection like two or three times over, so I'm good.
It's gonna be interesting to see that zombie apocalypse with Mike trying to spin records. At least he can get a portable CD player.
Yeah, but I like I said, I got my CD player. I've got a little CD player in my trunk, man.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
All right, you're good
so
to go.
I'm set for the zombie apocalypse, man.
I'll just rip some shit off the CD and be gone.
Yep.
That's the thing. I can rip stuff to CDs too.
Can you do that from Spotify?
Spotify, I don't know. I don't have Spotify.
No, I don't think you can. I don't think you can like take anything off of any streaming.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to take. I mean, I had before I got back into vinyl. It was like I had everything hard copy, you know, CDs. Everything like in the 90s that I pretty much owned on vinyl, I rebought on CD anyway. And then I would take the CD and I would rip it, like Pat said, I would rip it to the computer. And then, you know, when by the time smartphones came around, now you have it in your phone.
Yeah, that's pretty much
and
what I do.
You can stream it in your car, you know?
Yep.
Oh, I was a pirate. how I got under getting served with any kind of legal action, I'll never know. I accumulated thousands upon thousands of records and songs. And I remember having the first Audio Slave record like 2 weeks before it even came out. And I brought it to the bar and it was playing it in the bar.
Trouble.
I never got into the downloading, man. I never did that. Like during that period, I was still heavily buying CDs during that period.
I tried it for a couple of years, but then the quality of them, the quality was just wasn't there.
So yeah, I was using
LimeWire for about 2 months until I got the virus, the mother of all viruses, man. It wiped me out. And I had to just literally start from scratch.
Joe's spot on though. You were losing, what is it called? Lossless audio or something like that. You were losing audio files, but definitely hate it.
Yeah, it's too generated. Fucking generated. Yep.
Impressed or whatever, I guess, right? Yeah. But there are other sites that are out there where you're getting like the FLAC audio on it, I guess it's called. I've kind of lost touch with it over the years. But I guess that's like the FLAC audio is supposedly like the true way the record should sound. And there's a huge difference. I mean, I'm sure you guys have heard digital audio compared to, you know, like you say, like a vinyl record or even a compact disc. I mean, there's a huge difference.
It's the difference is digital versus analog, but there's also a misconception with that because it's on vinyl, like you could buy one of these 180 gram pieces, you know, these new vinyls that they're putting out, and it's nice to have a new print. And if you don't really care about the sound, great. But some of like the remastered vinyl is coming from the CD masters.
It's
coming from digital anyway. You know, if it's coming from the original source and it's sourced from the analog tape, great. But a lot of new vinyl prints are sourced from the digital version that the CDs were made from. So it's kind of like vinyl to CD, and CD to vinyl.
That makes a big difference.
You know, so yeah, they sound great because they're coming from they're sourced from the CDs. I think that's what Kiss did. I don't know that for a fact, but I think that the Kiss 2014 remasters are sourced from the CDs that came out in the 90s or something.
Here's a random question for you. Go ahead, Joe. No, go ahead. I'll ask the question later. Go ahead.
Some of the remastered CDs, the quality isn't that good.
Hmm.
The analog albums have a much better sound.
Yeah, tape is always the way to go. Tape, they say that tape is, there's no comparison when you listen to tape. I mean, you can't get as cute with it. If you wanted to remaster it and do something different with it, you know, you can't get as cute with it other than adjusting levels, I suppose. But that's the way to go. My question actually was, because we've been talking metal all day, what are your feelings on the Ghost?
I like some of their songs. I'm not a huge fan.
Okay.
I like them. I would probably go see them because I heard their shows are pretty cool. I actually, believe it or not, I like some of their ABBA covers that they did. They're pretty good.
Sick. They actually opened for Maiden when I saw Maiden on the Book of Souls tour. And they did something smart in that they cut out all the very melodic intro stuff.
Uh-huh.
Excuse me.
It's all metal.
I think they figured, you know, we're opening for Iron Maiden. These guys are, this is the real deal here. And they came out and hit you with a good metal show. And it was really smart of them to do. I think they picked up a lot of fans by doing so. Maybe they lost a few by people going into those records and saying, what the hell is this horseshit? Because some of it is just too much. I'm like, what are you doing here? I'm not trying to listen to opera. I want to hear a good metal record. But you're spot on about the stage show. It's legit. It's just really, really good.
The funny thing about Ghost is they're huge. They're so popular, but I don't think a lot of people are listening to the lyrics.
Yeah, no.
they are the pop version of King Diamond.
Yeah.
So I think they might even be worse.
That's a great point, man. Such a great point. Like, he is. Are you serious?
Oh,
you're not listening to the lyrics of that song?
what are the lyrics? I don't know. Like, what is it? What is the content, man, inside the lyrics?
Pure Satanism.
It is, huh?
Oh, my God.
Wow.
You guys there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, it's recording again.
All right.
I'm so sorry about that.
That's fine, man. It's fine. Now that it's happened, we know that it's not a big issue. That we can just call back and just pick up right on the...
Yeah.
Like, I'll merge and you record.
That's fine.
That'll work. I just got to get this thing going, like, figure out what's what. But anyway, so what I asked Joe before before Pat got cut off, for just, I'll use this as a reference point to pick up and thread the two files together when I release the episode in the edit. But before Pat got cut off, I was asking Joe, or anybody, I was asking you too, Pat, anybody that wants to answer, like, what's the difference between like Ghost coming up with content like that in the lyrics and the imagery, versus Marilyn Manson doing that in the 90s? Is it the same kind of music? Is it a different fan base? Does Marilyn Manson qualify as metal, or was he something else?
He was definitely heavier, I think.
Oh, without doubt.
More radio oriented.
Marilyn Manson was more radio oriented.
No,
yeah.
Ghosted.
Oh,
yeah,
Ghosted?
That's what. Yeah.
Okay.
I think
what I wanted to say, though, you touched on it before with King Diamond. I think they're a clone of King Diamond, to be honest with you. I really feel that way.
The setup, yeah, just the singing's different.
Is different, and the you know, King Diamond and Merciful Fate were just an all-out barrage, like, you know, pummeling you with it, where Ghost really doesn't at all times.
Right. And I think the difference between Ghost and Manson, basically, Manson was more of a shock factor, shock show. He was severe, I think.
And what about this band, Motionless in White? They seem to be very, very, like, almost like the same formulaic thing as Marilyn Manson. Is that, are you familiar with them?
The few songs I heard, I didn't care for, so I really don't.
It all kind of sounds as very compressed, quick, like almost like a, like, it's, I don't know, the drum sound. Is that metal these days? Is that what metal sounds like these days? I mean, I'm seriously in the dark here on
metal. I don't know what metal sounds like these days.
A lot of it is like that. A lot.
Yeah.
Because there's a million metal bands. They all sound the same.
Yeah.
It's real bad. I mean, there are the ones.
Is that just us getting old, man, or is it just like, is it really the same?
I like a lot of new bands, so I guess yeah. I can, you know, I like.
There's some legitimacy to what you're saying.
Yeah. But you know what? It's a different crowd. You know, the kids like that sound, and they don't like everybody sounds the same. So, you know, at least back in the 80s, you know, Motley Crue didn't sound like Priest. Priest didn't sound like Maiden.
That's true.
Slayer didn't sound like Priest. You know, no one really, you know, wasn't a lot that sounded alike.
That's true. You know, I was never a Motley Crue fan. I did not like Motley Crue, but you know what? You knew it was Motley Crue. They had their sounds. You know,
yeah.
You knew Vince Neil's voice, man.
Yep.
You know, even the bands I didn't like, man, you knew it was them. There was no band, there was no two bands that sounded exactly the same, but you couldn't tell apart.
I could play you 10 bands right now that you wouldn't be able to tell who's who.
No, I believe you. I totally believe you.
And don't get me wrong, there's a lot of good stuff out there. There is, but there's just so much of that.
Yeah.
And the problem is, a lot of people categorize that as metal, and everything else isn't metal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you get those metal snobs on the internet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think to a certain extent we were dealing with that back in the 80s. You know, but it was different. It was metal kind of fractured in once Slack was, wait, what's that? Thrash. Once Thrash kind of took hold.
It became
like the mainstream. Because Slack, you know, Thrash did become the mainstream after a while.
Absolutely.
Everything else, you're a poser, man. You know, once the Slayer fans took over, you know,
but you
couldn't be fast enough. You couldn't be heavy enough. It was who can drum the fastest and who can play the fastest riff and whose foot was the fastest on the drums.
But here's the thing. Before, like you said, before Thrash, you had people that, you know, you like Motley Crue, you like Priest, you like Maiden, you even liked, trying to think of more poppier type bands. But, you know, you were the Cheap Trick, you liked the Cars, you know, you liked even some of the rock stuff, but as soon as Thrash hit, you couldn't like all that.
Yeah, and even to a certain extent, like even around metal, like even before Thrash, I remember going to school, like I remember starting freshman year, you know, and it's just, you know, everybody knows I'm a big Springsteen fan. You know, I grew up with Springsteen, and you know, my dad was into Springsteen. There was a lot of Springsteen in my house, and so I remember when the summer of Born in the USA was the summer before freshman year. And I remember saying like, you know, and I was like, also Defenders of the Faith was the new Priest album at the time. So I was a big Priest fan, you know, and so I was living proof that you can be a Springsteen fan and a metalhead. But I remember saying, like, somebody found out, like, what? Fuck Bruce Springsteen. You're gay.
So true.
You know, dude, you like Bruce Springsteen, you're gay. You know, so it was like, there was a lot of that already, man.
Well, my secret band was Chicago. So back when we were, you know, the whole metal thing, I would go home and like, that was one of my favorite bands, Chicago, especially the older stuff. And I would just, I wouldn't tell a soul, but I had every album. Even the newer stuff, I kept buying them. I went to their concerts, but I never told anybody.
we were all in the closet about some other bands, man. Some bands.
Mine trumps these both.
What's yours? Yeah.
But I grew up around a lot of R&B and soul. My mom's huge Motown fan.
Yep.
So mine was Hall & Oates.
Oh, I love Hall & Oates.
I love Hall & Oates, even back then.
Oh, my God, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, that was enough. But I couldn't let that get out, man. People were like, what are you fucking kidding me? Go home.
Hall & Oates was big when I was like fifth and sixth grade. So I was able to say I could listen to it at that point, but then it stopped as soon as I went to junior high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was still listening to their records. I definitely was.
Actually, I got an even better one for you, and this is going to blow both your minds. The Stylistics.
Oh, wow. I love them.
My mother was a huge fan. She got
them now, man.
Oh, I love them.
Priest remade one of their songs. They never, it was, there's like about a minute and a half of their version on YouTube. I forgot what song it was, man, but the Priest actually remade it, Stylistic Songs, in I think, for Ram It Down.
Yes. Huh. They actually had a lot of songs for Ram It Down and never made it out.
Yeah. But, and that's exactly it, man. There was just like you weren't allowed, but you were just almost like afraid of what your friend's reaction was going to be, like if you admitted to liking anything that wasn't Slayer. Or wasn't like metal related, and that was the problem. And that hasn't gone away.
No, it still exists. It's definitely still out there.
Now that we're adults, it doesn't matter.
Right.
But I saw and I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, man. And I'm not going to name the name, but I saw somebody posted about a month or two ago. It's probably more like 2 or 3 months ago now. But posted a song that was, I don't remember if it was REO Speedwagon or if it was something that was far from metal, and he felt the need to explain himself, almost like he was apologizing for posting it. Dude, this song is actually pretty good if you listen to it. Dude, if you fucking like it, it's good. Nobody's gonna make fun of you, dude. You're in your 50s. Relax.
Yeah.
This is not 1985 anymore. You can say you like something without having to take shit for it.
Yeah.
It's the metal thing, man. And punks go through that too, to a large extent.
I think punks are probably a little worse.
Yeah, they're extreme.
Yeah.
They got their niches.
We're not living in that Mean Girls era. The cliques, at 50 years old, I don't give a shit about a clique. Go jump in a lake.
The one thing I do like is I like blowing people's minds is when I I'll listen to Slayer, and then on my phone Bee Gees will come up, and then it'll go back to Priest, and then the next song will be Dion, and then I'll go to Little Richard, and then to Bon Jovi. And I just like blowing people's minds like that.
You obviously the same upbringing in terms of the music that you grew up around. I grew up, I listened to Priest and I listened to Bruce and I listened to all the metal stuff and I listened to everything that every kid our age was listening to back in the 80s. But at the breakfast table every morning at 7 o'clock, there was the AM radio tuned to not AM, but the little clock radio.
WTF.
My mother had tuned to CBS. So, you got Dion and you got the doo-wop and you got,
Motown.
Shaboom. Oh, yeah. and the Duprees and things like that. So yeah, that's all in my DNA too.
And I grown up to appreciate it. As a kid, I hated it because it was on all the time. But now I really appreciate it now.
Yeah.
It's etched. It's part of your fiber, man. It's etched in there and there's just no way around it. We're all 50, man. We're all 50. We don't need to defend what we listen to anymore. That's the beauty of it.
No.
It's just piss off.
And I never really had to, man. There was a couple times where people were like, yeah, you like that, But I can't say I really ever hated anything, man. A lot of the stuff that I like now that I'll admit to, yeah, I always liked it, man. There was never a time when I disliked the Bee Gees. And the Bee Gees were always made fun of in the 80s.
Yes, I love
them. Before the 70s came full circle in the 90s, they were so uncool in the 80s, if you remember. So, but I was kind of quietly liked it. There was never, I always liked Hall & Oates. I liked Culture Club in 1983, There was just, I didn't buy the records, but, if I heard it, I was like, yeah, this is a good song. I don't hate this. If I say I hate it, I feel like I hate it because I'm supposed to hate it. You hated it under pressure more than actually hated it.
Exactly.
A guy like Clive Davis, the brilliance of that man is a good song is a good song, and that's it. That's the bottom line. He was all about making money, but he made superstars. Absolutely. You know, and he took a guy like Carlos Santana and made him win, what did he win, 7 Grammy Awards for that record? Supernatural, right, exactly. That was his biggest selling record of his career.
It's a great album.
It is a fantastic album. Really, really enjoy that record a lot.
He did for Santana what Quentin Tarantino did for John Travolta.
Yeah.
Call people back to life.
Yeah, really. And yeah, I mean then he finds Whitney Houston. I mean that's just, but you know he was all about making a good song, and you know that came through in that documentary that I watched of him on Netflix. It was just outstanding the way this guy ran his business and how they just kept ousting him, and he kept proving everybody wrong. Man, you're not doing right by me, and here's another super successful artist.
So I got a good Whitney Houston story for you. So my dad's first store was in Newark, and I was actually pretty much like born in it. So I figure it was big, 69, 70. I think he closed it in 71. But one of his big customers was Sissy Houston, which is Whitney's. So she would come in and order all the gospel records. She would always order from him. And my dad's neighbor at the time, because my dad lived down the street, was Dionne Warwick, which is Whitney's cousin.
Whitney's cousin or aunt, right?
Yeah, cousin. My dad. So it was a big family thing. They all lived in the area. So a little girl with pigtails used to come into my dad's store all the time and ask for lollipops. And that ended up Whitney Houston.
That was Whitney.
That's incredible. Yep. That's a great story.
Because Whitney wasn't that much older than us, right? She was, her first...
Like three or four years older than us.
She was only like in her late teens, early 20s when her first record came out. So she was, that makes sense. Wow.
So she was like a 5-year-old, 4-year-old girl walking into a store asking for lollipops.
Wow.
That's insane.
Yeah, it was one of the stories my dad told me that kind of blew my mind.
That's cool.
My dad actually had like a ton of friends in the business. Like he was actually, Dionne is a close family friend to us.
I'm sure, man. You got that many stores, man, for that long in various places. You're going to meet people and you're going to have some pretty cool friends.
Yeah, so it was just funny though that his next door neighbor was Dionne Warwick though.
Dionne was from Dionne DiMucci, is that his last name?
Yeah.
From Brooklyn?
Bronx.
Oh, the Bronx, that's right. How could I forget? And you know what my favorite, and again, like I like, you know, I know a lot of Dionne, but you know what my favorite Dionne was, and this is how it may sound cheesy to you, but I love that song he put out in 89, King of the New York Streets.
That album was great.
I love that song when it came out, man.
And then there was another big, Heartbreak or something off that album. That was another big song. But that was actually
a new one.
That was actually a very heavy album at the time. Mm-hmm. Because my dad was the president of his fan club at that time.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, so my dad actually ran like a banquet show and Dionne played and they played that thing. And I was, I'm like 5 years old, 6 years old, I don't remember, sitting there and watching him. And he was like, actually, I could say that's probably the first, because he wasn't doing any of the doo-wops. He was basically playing that album and kind of made rock versions of some of his oldie songs. That was probably the first rock show I ever seen.
Wow.
And I thought like the guitarist was heavy as hell at the time.
Yeah.
But like I said, when you're 6 years old or 7 years old and it's the first rock concert, it sounds.
My first concert was not far from Dionne, man. I grew up with the first, very, very first music I was ever exposed to was Frankie Valli, you know, the Four Seasons. And I saw them in 1974 at the Convention Hall with not Dionne, man, with Jay Black. And I didn't know who Jay Black was. I was later told that it was Jay Black because I was only 4 years old. But we would go see Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons every year. We would see him at the Garden State Arts Center, like 75. I remember the night before I started kindergarten, I went to a Frankie Valli concert. And I brought in the tour program. I brought it to school to show my teacher on the first day of kindergarten.
That was a staple in my house, the Four Seasons.
Yeah, same here, man. Same here.
Stop.
Good times, man. Good times. But we're coming up on almost an hour and a half, Joe. I want to do some random gun to the head questions.
Okay.
Before we, you know, like this, before we wrap up, man. All right, Jay, Pat, do you have any gun to the head questions for Joe or for anyone?
No.
Well, just we'll go
no,
around, man. No, because I just
no,
want to say,
no.
Like, all right. So, like, again, we graduated together. You know, we went to school together, and then we went, and 30 years went by, you know, and then magically Facebook happens, right? And then we all see each other at the bar every now and again. But in that time frame, man, of you know, going through post-metal years, man, and whatever else you were listening to in the 90s and the 2000s, what is your favorite band to come out of? I want to say, all right, let's do, all right, the last 20 years.
My
like
favorite
what's your favorite band? Do you have a favorite band to come out of the 20th century, meaning that their first album had to have been from 2000 or after?
Yes.
What?
Volbeat,
wow.
Love them.
Yeah.
Like wow. Rockabilly metal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Misfits meets Elvis,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
That's a great way of looking at
that. Yeah,
check that out. I love them. Every album, there's not an album I don't like. From day one till the last album they just made, just one of my absolute favorite bands.
What was your favorite band to come out of the 90s?
Oh, that's a good question. Favorite band out of the 90s.
Remember, there's a gun to your head.
It's not loaded.
No, man, we'll give you the benefit of an extra 60 seconds.
It's not loaded. It's just there.
Yeah, it's just there.
I'm not gonna say they were my favorite band at that time, but I was. I like Disturbed a lot. I thought they were really different. I thought they brought something really different to the table.
Yeah.
And amazing live.
Mm-hmm.
Avenged Sevenfold. I'm going to say Avenged Sevenfold.
Okay. They're very big bands.
I would have went out of the 90s. The most interesting thing that came out, obviously I'm a huge Pearl Jam fan, but the most mm-hmm. interesting thing that came out of the 90s for me might've been Tool.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Very cool
just
band.
Based on the sheer, they are not like anything I've ever heard. They don't sound like anybody. Nobody sounds like them. That would be my answer to that question. That was an interesting question. And both bands that you mentioned, Disturbed and Avenged Sevenfold, are two top notch things that came out of that era for sure.
And they're both huge, man, to this day, right? They're like currently huge bands, right?
Disturbed more than, yeah. Disturbed probably a little more, right?
Disturbed kind of, they actually came out with an album 2 years ago and it really didn't hit big at all. So I don't know if they're on their down decline now. So, but with Tool for me, I like them a lot. Like you said, they're beyond different compared to everybody else. It's just that some of their stuff got a little spacey for me.
Okay.
Definitely a cool band from the 90s. Because the whole grunge thing, I really didn't appreciate any of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I liked Alice in Chains. I liked Pearl Jam, Soundgarden a little bit. But nothing really grunge-wise stuck for me. Those are probably the three best bands.
Yeah, I didn't listen to a lot of it. I liked some of the grunge, but not a whole lot of it.
Yeah.
But, 90s for me, 90s is I would say Stereolab. That was my favorite band to come out of the 90s. They were like very French pop, like psychedelic synth stuff. And out of the last two decades, I guess the 2000s would be the Strokes. I think without question, the Strokes. I
very good band.
Fell in love with their first album, man. It was just knocked me in the nuts, man. Just totally kicked my ass that first album. I was like preaching that first album. And it was like, you know, I associated, unfortunately, I associated kind of with 9/11, because it came out that month. And I remember the first time going into Vintage Vinyl, like soon after 9/11, and hearing it and thinking it was the Velvet Underground or something. And it was some like lost Lou Reed album or something. I was like, oh my God, what is this? And then another song came on and another song came on. I went up to the counter. I said, what is this? I got to buy it, you know? And
it's good to have that reaction.
I'm not crazy about their new record. For the first time, there's something I really don't like from them, but they've been consistent for the past, though they only have like 5 or 6 albums, but I've liked the majority of it. There's some that I can't stand actually, but I've liked the majority of it. And there's not a whole lot of bands that I've liked over the past 20 years, but that's one band I love, man. So, best concert you ever seen?
For me?
Yeah.
Believe it or not, Dream Theater.
Wow.
Okay. You know, what? I think I may have asked you. I think I may have asked you that at last party because I remember that answer.
Actually, my whole grunge time was Dream Theater.
Dream Theater.
I wasn't into the grunge thing, and Dream Theater was also hitting at the same time. That became my band.
What do you think of Queensryche? That's a totally random question, but what do you think of Queensryche, man?
One of my all-time favorite bands.
Okay, yeah, me too. I liked them until Empire. I liked Empire, but I didn't like
Empire was probably the last great album by them.
Yeah.
I'm in agreement with that.
I just, for whatever reason, when you said Dream Theater, I think of like kind of like the same similar genre, man.
Dream Theater
tends to like Queensryche, man.
Progressive metal.
Yeah.
I love Mike Portnoy.
Oh, he's unbelievable.
The drummer. Yeah, and I love the Winery Dogs, the stuff that he did with Richie Kotzen and Billy Sheehan. Record, both records.
That's a big change for him, though. It was because it was basically just like good time rock.
Yeah, absolutely. Because he played with Avenged, right?
He played with a million bands.
Yeah, the guy, he's the like hardest working drummer in the industry probably right now.
Honestly, he probably recorded for 50 to 60 different bands already.
Wow. You're 100% correct. That was just a good time rock and roll roots, bluesy, you know, obviously Kotzen, you know, you're going to get that out of Kotzen anyway. But yeah, that was a big change for him. Was that?
You know what's funny? I hate Richie Kotzen's solo album.
So do I.
I hate him.
He's an arrogant fuck.
Yeah.
That's my opinion of him. It really is.
The Winery Dogs was fantastic.
Yep.
Winery Dogs, man.
Three guys getting together to put out some good, two good records. Rumor has it they got some stuff coming again soon. We'll see what happens with that. You know, COVID probably hurt that a little bit, but.
Yeah. Well, Billy Sheehan's just beyond remarkable.
Yeah, another guy that's the hardest working bass player in the industry.
Yeah. Oh, my God. And then just when him and Steve Vai get together, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. That's
pure magic
right there, man. Yeah, it is.
Pure magic.
I remember
only time I got to see Billy was when he was with Mr. Big and they opened for Rush.
I was just going to say, one of my favorite concert memories, man, after all these years, was I saw Billy Sheehan the first time I saw him. Actually, the only time I saw him was with Callis. He opened up for Yngwie at the old Capitol Theater in Passaic.
Yep.
And Callis opened, and Yngwie did a show. And at the end, the encore, and it was the last night of the tour, with the Rape and Pillage tour, 85. Billy came out. And they did Purple Haze together.
Wow.
And, it was good, man. You could see the cockiness, man, and the egos. And just Yngwie was at his most arrogant. You know, Yngwie was like 21, man. You know, he wasn't much older than us, you know. And Billy was kind of a seasoned vet at the time already. And you could just see the egos, but there was like this not standoffish. There was almost like this mutual silent respect of each other that they were just kind of doing their, and Billy's wailing and Yngwie's wailing and they're both doing their thing. And it was just like watching, I guess, because if you were a kid, everything's magnified when you're a kid.
Absolutely.
You know, everything is magnified. So even though Yngwie was only on his first tour, and Callis wasn't all that well known.
They sucked.
We were watching gods. You know what I mean? We were like, you know, giants, like dwarves standing on the shoulders of the giants, man. And
it was like a prize fight.
God, man. Yeah, you know, it was like I guess, and now I look back on it and I'm like, well, it was cool to see Billy and Inge, but they were very young and they weren't really anybody yet. We thought they were, just to see them at that point in time where they were young men and they were in their 20s and they had most of their catalog was still ahead of them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it hadn't been written yet. So that's one of my favorite concert memories.
That's a good Billy story.
Yeah, and I remember Jeff Scott Soto coming out and throwing fruit into that. Like I caught a banana from Jeff Scott Soto with fruit basket.
And
I told him that. And I told him that on Twitter, but he didn't answer me.
Oh, this is a good episode, man. I really appreciate you coming on, Joe.
I'm glad we finally did this.
It was very nostalgic for me to remember those days walking down Cherry Street. I can't even count the times I was in that store. We had to have run into each other in that place. We had to have. I mean, I don't look anything like I did then.
I worked too much.
Yeah. I mean, I was, I don't know, 110 pounds, 130 pounds soaking wet, and it was just all hair.
We were all like that. We were all like thin and long hair, man, and just, you know. That's why I don't even have a thought with that. I'll edit that part out.
That's why we've become lazy. That's why we've become lazy old men.
Dude, I've lost more hair in the last 6 months, man, than I have in the last 20 years. When I finally cut my hair, man, you're gonna see the receding hairline.
That's one thing I'm fortunate for is the hair. And Mike, you can attest to that. I recently just cut it, 3 years ago? It was super long again.
Well, you had long hair when I first met you, I thought you looked like Dave Grohl.
Yeah. Somebody else told me that once.
I thought you looked just like Dave Grohl when I first met you, man. And then you had long hair and then you cut it and then you grew it back for a couple of years and then you cut it again.
Yeah.
My hair is like shoulder length now, man. My hair is like total my hair is like shoulder length now, but like it's like the longest it's been in like 20 years. And but when I cut it, man, like I've got nothing on top, bro. my hair is gone, bro. It's fucking gone. So when I cut it, bro, it's gonna be like, what the fuck happened to him? You know?
And with that, we'll throw the metal horns up.
The metal horns, yeah. The metal god. Anyway, man. Joe, this was fun, man. It was definitely good to finally have you do this.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me on anytime.
And I got to just another shout out to you in our audience, man. Joe is the guy who hooked us up with Richie Rano, which turned out to be a really, really great conversation. So, yeah. Again, I can't thank you enough for that, because that turned out to be one of my favorite shows. And he was like nice enough to actually, he was the only person that I've ever followed an interview with a piece of his music, you know. And he was just like, you know, because there's always licensing issues on YouTube, especially on YouTube.
Licensing, that's why.
Yeah. And so I got his blessing. I was like, man, you know, I'd love to use one of your songs, because, you know, because I asked him about this one particular song. And he was kind of like blown away that I knew as much as I did about him, and that we, you know, because he's like, most people don't do their homework. He's like, you at least do your homework. I said, yeah, you know. But I asked him about this song, and I was like, you know what, man? Like, do you mind, man? Like, I'd like to play the song. And he's like, nah, fucking play it. Go ahead. You know. And so that was a great show. So I thank you for setting that up.
Yeah, no problem. He's another family friend, so, you know, he was friends with everybody in the family.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that Stars got out there and started the tour again, you know, the Stars Angels tour that happened last year, 2 years ago.
Yeah, actually, I think they were still going on, and then the pandemic happened.
And then, yeah. I talked to Richie once since then, man, and it was just a message on Facebook, but I haven't actually talked to him since that day. But you know, I mean, he's cool, man. You know, he stays in touch. You know, he wishes me happy birthday every year, you know. And
yeah,
he's a cool dude, man. You know, he's a cool dude. He says, you know, a lot of times you meet somebody and they just, you never talk to him again, man. And he stays in touch with me through Facebook ever since.
Yeah, he's
so,
definitely.
It's kind of cool, man. Very cool, actually.
Bad news keeps pouring on me, bad.